Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hello and welcome to Off the Beaten Track podcast. I'm your host, I'm Stu Whiffin. It's another week, therefore it's another episode. Today's episode, I sit down with Will Gould of Creeper and we have a wonderful chat. And you're really going to enjoy this. We speak about all the songs that have been really important in Will's creative journey, and we talk about, you know, the punk scene, and we talk about the metal scene, and we talk about so much stuff. We talk about creativity in music and that visual aesthetic in music, and it's a really good chat, and you're going to enjoy it. And before we get on with that chat, I just want to say thank you to Scroobius Pip and everybody at the Distraction Pieces Network. Also, I want to say a huge thanks to 76 for producing this podcast. And also, if this is your first time listening to Off the Beaten Track, then please go and have a look in the archives. We mention Dan P. Carter in this podcast. If you go and search the archives, you can hear a great episode with Dan P. Carter. You can also hear episodes with Dan Carter's former bandmates in the Bloodhound Gang and Adam Perry and Jason Perry. And there's about 150 episodes with all your favourite musicians, producers, DJs, actors, comedians. Go and have a rummage and you'll find something that you like. But back to business. Please enjoy today's episode with the wonderful Will Gould of Creeper. I've got an announcement. Save Our Souls Clothing. www.sosclothing.co.uk. Why am I telling you this? Because they're our official sponsor. Yeah, that's right. Go and check them out because their clothing is off the scale. You're going to love it. So they've decided they want to be our sponsor, which is amazing. And what I have to do is I have to tell you about why they're amazing. So here's a little bit of blurb. So they've only been going a year. And they're based in Southend-on-Sea, just up the road from me. They put the company together based on a love of tattoos and alternative music. And they've worked with some of the greatest artists around the world to produce these items of clothing that are as unique as you lot. All of the designs are printed using biodegradable, sustainable and water-based inks. And in addition to that, they only print on garments made by members of Fair Wear Foundation. I mean, come on, great clothing and a conscience. Since going live in April last year, they've seen their audience grow massively and are now selling orders all across the world. And they were recognised by Cosmopolitan magazine as one of the best sustainable clothing brands alongside names such as Stella McCartney. I mean, that's quite a first year, right? So go and check them out, because they've put a lot of love into supporting this podcast and I couldn't be happier. What else they've done is they've given you 15% off. So if you head over to www.sosclothing.co.uk, do a bit of shopping, see what you like, throw it in the basket, and then on the way out, put in the discount code BEAT15, BEAT15, and that'll save you 15% off. Amazing, right? www.sosclothing.co.uk. Official sponsors of Off the Beaten Track podcast. Let's get back to that podcast.
It's Off the Beaten Track podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network with me, Stu Whiffin.
Hello and welcome to Off the Beaten Track podcast. And joining me today via the means of Zoom is Will Gould of Creeper. Hello.
Hello, Stu. How are you?
I'm good, mate. How are you?
Yeah, not too bad. It's another day waking up without having a haircut, which is a bit problematic for me, you know. But I'm desperate to get out to a barber. Have you managed to do that yet?
I have. I've managed to get a hairdresser to come round and sat in the garden and done my wife's hair. And I was like, do you do like guys' hair as well? And he was like, yes, of course I do. I was like, oh, I just wanted to ask. And so, yeah, I managed to get a haircut. But up until then, my daughter had been sort of hacking away and done an half-decent job, you know, of what's left on the top of my head. But yeah, I did drive past Q's to the barbers the other day, and they were huge.
It looks mad. I think that's one of the things. I know it's such a ridiculous, like a vanity thing, a vain thing to say. But it's one of the main things I've missed. I just feel so unpleasant every time my hair grows out over my ears and stuff. And so my girlfriend's been doing the same thing, as hacking the sides off. We bought like a pair of clippers off eBay. She's been doing the sides, but she won't touch the top. And when my hair is so thick, it just kind of mushrooms out at the top. It's awful every single day, you know. And it's the good thing is, that's the one good thing about being in lockdown and promoting an album. I haven't had to have my picture taken too much because we can't get together with a photographer. So I feel like it would be a nightmare if I was photographed right now. My hair's just disgusting.
I mean, before we get on to the songs that you've picked, Will, how have you found, you know, hair aside, how have you found like lockdown as both a human being and as a creative?
The thing is about it, to be honest with you, is like we're from punk rock, and so like the idea of kind of making something with limited resources is the way we started in the first place, you know, in Ian's shed writing songs at his mum's house, you know. We're used to making something out of nothing. So the idea of making content in this time, it's kind of been more of a fun challenge than anything else as a creative. I haven't found that too bad. Like I've kind of enjoyed the challenge of it all a little. On a personal level, it's you know, like I have days when everything's absolutely fine. I have those days, and I'm sure you do as well, where you wake up and you're just like, what am I doing? Like, this is so frustrating. I just want to be outside. Why aren't we on tour? Why aren't we doing this? But I try to keep in mind the fact that this really, as far as who this affects the most, I'm pretty far down the list. I try to keep the focus of that, and that kind of grounds me a little bit. And I've been very lucky to be locked in with my girlfriend a lot of this time. And I know people with partners who they were just didn't see for 3 months, you know. So, yeah. Been fortunate.
Okay, well, let's kick things off. Track one, Will, the song with the greatest ever intro.
So I've gone for Modern Love, David Bowie. And I think I was thinking about this, and I feel like I've got a good choice with this one. I feel like I've done a good job. You know, I was like, I had a few different choices, and I was like, well, I think when that comes on, you know, when you're out on the piss and that comes on in a nightclub, the whole room just knows what's coming. It's the anticipation, yeah. the build. And when it pops in to, you know, when it goes into that pocket straight after that, it's just amazing. And it reminds me of a few different things. It reminds me of being out, but it also reminds me of being like at a wedding with my dad. It's, you know, this wedding songs.
Like, oh, it's a real wedding classic.
It is. But it's the B-52's Love Shack. It's all of those songs that I can imagine my dad in my head. I know exactly how he danced to it. He dances the same to every single song. And that's the song that gets everyone moving. And I think as soon as you hear that kind of the kind of male, all male choir, I think it's kind of a barbershoppy part, like over the top of that, the build to that. It's just the anticipation of the drop coming in. Just amazing. That's such a great job. We just did our homage to it on this record. We just did it on a song called Thorns of Love, where I had Hannah layer up loads of vocals in a similar manner to pop into this kind of doo-wop-y thing we were doing. But it's just amazing. It's taking like a classic trope, isn't it? And reimagining it for pop music. That's what Bowie was doing there. It's so cool. Like, what a great intro.
I mean, this question I'm really interested to ask you, Will, is because I ask all musicians this, and generally, a lot of the guests that I've had on here, I would say are clearly older than you, and so you've very much grown up in a generation that has been, you know, music has been driven by things like MySpace and the evolution of Spotify and things like that. So what I want to ask you is, which I ask all musicians, is when you approach songwriting and predominantly the intro, how much has that changed over the time your band's been going, and what are the considerations now when you're creating an intro in regards to the way that people listen to music now? It's a very loaded question, bear with me. How people listen to music now in regards to, you know, are you writing with radio as a consideration and with Spotify? You know, there's so many things that distract you from the song you're listening to, like you might like this, you might like this. Are you aware, is it a consideration that you should hook them quickly?
I think like that's like a like a very pop music thing to do. Yeah. Like that, and when my band started out, we were the punk band, you know, so we wouldn't have paid any attention to that at all for the first few years, but that's because we were just trying to, we were learning how to write songs still. I think now I absolutely think about every part of the song. We speak about when we're playing, about serving the song, instrument, like with instruments, and not overplaying on guitar, not overplaying on drums, et cetera, et cetera. But also like the structure of the song. Me and Ian used to do this thing we used to call the song snake. And it was a series of post-it notes you put up. And so it meant that like you could change around the structure of a song like really, really quickly. So you'd have intro, verse, you know, the classic structure, but intro, verse, chorus, you know, bridge, whatever, intro, verse, chorus, bridge, chorus, end, you know. But you can move it around all the time. But intro is one of the things that I've always think, I think as time's gone on, it's become more and more important to me. Not necessarily to hook them quick, although that does play a part in some of our more recent material. But on our last record, our record opened the intro to the actual whole album, and the intro to the first song, Black Rain, was a spoken word piece over the top of some piano and some organ and some a choir in the background. And I think like setting the tone and preparing people, preparing the listener for what's about to come, like conditioning the listener for what's about to come in the song. The intro is a very, very important part of that. In terms of like pop music and stuff, the song Cyanide we've just done, it starts with the hook on the piano. And the idea is that you repeat something enough times, you know, during over the course of a song, that's like an earworm, it gets caught in your head. And I, even when I was writing it, it was driving me crazy. I've heard it so many times now. But I love the idea of that. I love the idea of hooking them like that. But I think that you're very right in I guess some of the points you're making, like in the question. People, you basically have a few seconds to hook someone's attention now. We have the shortest attention span for music than I can remember. When I was a kid, we were still going to HMV on the day a record came out, buying it and consuming it on my Discman on the way home on the bus, you know. Long gone are those days. We don't even have a HMV in Southampton anymore. And we don't have any record stores here. It's crazy. No, I don't know where you buy a CD on the high street here. So it's an interesting one, isn't it? Like you kind of have to get in quick because there's more music than ever. People can make music, good sounding records and productions at home. And you can put something on the internet. So if people are going to give you a try, they're spoiled for choice. So they're not often they don't give you very long at all. It's really interesting you ask that. One of the other things is like there's a producer in America I met, John Feldman. When we would play him songs, he'd only listen up to the chorus and then he'd switch song like all the time. That's how he'd kind of identify with the demos and things. Wouldn't listen further. Thought that's interesting.
Really?
Yeah.
So you know, with that kind of listen to a bit of that, listen to a bit of that. And the fact that now so many people will just go on iTunes and cherry pick, you know, a couple of singles rather than buy the album. When you've put this album together, do you still have a traditional approach to putting a record together that it is a body of work, it's a piece of art, as, you know, in regards to, you know, the track listing, you know, is it something that you're keen to sort of present your album as a body of work?
I think, like, to be honest with you, like I'm a really unlikely musician. Like I wanted to make films. I always wanted to make movies when I was a kid. So, and the records that really I loved when I was a kid, like my favorite albums, you can probably guess them. Like if you know anything about like the stuff I grew up on, Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars. Obviously, it was a massive record for me. And those felt like kingdoms, you know, when you listen to them. And so the way things are structured and narrative and pacing of a record and That stuff to me is I hold that above almost everything else. Sometimes I have to be told to make something more suitable for radio, I think. It's just not the way I grew up digesting music. When I first got into music, I inherited my dad's record collection. And so would listen to vinyl like the same way my dad did. I was digesting music the same way my parents did back when they were kids. And the idea of listening to the whole thing and then turning the record over and listening to the other side and the ceremony of that and that feeling is still in me to this day. I struggle with the high rate of releases people are throwing out music to be relevant. And I know that's an important thing. I know I probably should adapt to that a little bit more, but I struggle with it. I feel like even when I was a kid, I had an old school approach, but now in my 30s, I think it's even more dated in the way. I want to take a year out to make a record. I want to be able to reimagine and redesign everything. And so, yeah, I think I much more see it in like a long form rather than a short single. I struggle with singles.
Okay, well, you know, talking about sort of parents' record collections and things like that leads us on nicely to track two. Well, what was the first song you remember hearing that had an emotional impact on you?
It's difficult for me because I had a few different answers for this one. It's like one of those questions where like I don't know. It's like I didn't know whether to answer it, whether like with the first song that I found for me that had an emotional impact on me.
You can have some honourable mentions. You can throw a few in.
Okay, so there's a few I think for me. I'm gonna go firstly. I'm gonna say Roxy Music More Than This. I think. That song, like, it's a pop song, but it's what a sad song that is. Like, what a truly, like, devastating song that is. And it's actually heightened as I got older when you see that scene in Lost in Translation, you know, where Bill Murray sings it on karaoke. And I remember thinking, because my dad was the biggest Roxy Music fan. We actually did a Roxy Music cover when we first started, Made of Ale, for my dad, you know. And I just grew up with all that stuff. He's been to see Brian Ferry loads of times. And, So for me, that song, I remember just thinking how incredible the lyrics were and the composition, and the way that Brian sings is so outrageous. There's that incredible Bob Dylan covers record he did, Dylan-esque, and the timbre of his voice from that, it's just crazy. How do you get that sound out of a human? It's mad, the control. So yeah, that's that one. I think my original one was AFI, the punk band, and I would have gone for Morning Star when I was doing that, because that was the first band that I found. That was a band that wasn't handed to me. I got into rock and metal when I was a kid because my older cousin gave it to me. You know, they gave me their records. The very starting point for music was given to me by my father. But then getting into alternative music was given to me by my older cousin. And when I found AFI, that was my first discovery. You know, that was just purely me. That was my band. You know, I'm sure you have those bands as well. And that song is at the end of The Art of Drowning, which is an incredible punk rock records, really seminal, I think, that when they really perfected that sound. Right on the end, a ballad. Weird to have a fast punk band that I got into because they sounded like The Offspring at first. And you can't imagine them like at The Offspring doing Morningstar. It's such a beautifully written song. And Davey does this kind of, he went really, really Danzig back in kind of like on All Hallows EP into Black Sails in the Sunset. But that song in particular, he's started to develop a real range with his voice. It was really, really powerful. He can sing really high, but it's really controlled. And the amazing placement about that as well is like after a record that's like as over the top and because at such a blisteringly fast pace as that album does, you have this kind of respite at the end, which I've always loved. I've been a sucker for it ever since Rock and Roll Suicide, you know. And just that grand ballad, the climax, the crescendo of the whole thing. And he's singing in such a reserved way, like through his teeth almost at the beginning, after hearing him yell for 40 minutes. And I just, I always remember that. I remember making like weird little art films when I was a kid and using that as a soundtrack for them, you know, just people walking through the woods and stuff in black and white on my mum's handy cam.
So, well, I'm curious to know what the emotion would have been that you felt.
So, with Morningstar, I think I probably, the thing about David Havoc's lyrics is it's very interpretive, especially around that period of time where he was like writing with he was an incredible lyricist. He was writing really articulately and using words. I had to use a dictionary to look up. So for me, I think at the time I'd moved schools and I moved to Southampton, and I didn't have very many friends, to be told. And I think that's, you know, something that's kind of really a bit of a really formative period of time because of that. I kind of made friends with records and with music instead, as so many of us do. And I remember being very sad and very lonely at the time. Like I was living with my brother. My mum worked like crazy hours and to support us. She worked for the NHS, and she'd be out and working in London, and just coming home super late. And so I didn't have that many people around, and especially like I think it was a really soothing piece of kind of something gentle and soft when I was probably quite angry as well. And so like a lot of the music I was listening to was very dramatic and angry, but it was like the first time I would sit on the school bus on the way to school and listen to that, and when it would get to that part, it kind of allowed me to be sad. It was like the only sad music I really listened to at that time. You got to remember, this is a time where everyone was listening to Limp Bizkit, you know, like and new metal, all that stuff was going on. So like there was kind of there was male fragility in some of that music, but it wasn't anywhere near on the scale of what was going on with this AFI song. It was really really speaking to me. And you know, the refrain is, "Am I your anything?" You know, "Am I the star? Am I the star beneath the stairs? Am I the ghost upon the stage? Am I your anything?" And I mean, it just speaks to every single teenager ever, doesn't it? You know, this is the classic stuff, the classic tropes of this genre. But it was just really beautifully written, really articulate, and performed by a man who was effeminate, and I was an effeminate little weird art kid, and so this was like. And when I didn't have many friends, and I felt so sad quite a lot of the time, this was like a place I could go, and a place that existed for me inside a record. And when you realize that there are these worlds inside these albums, that's when you really start loving music, and that's when you fall in love with this. And that's the problem. This is why I can't stop doing this. It's wrecked my whole life, but you know, I'm still here doing it because of that reason, I think.
Well, let's stay here for because track three, I'm going to ask you the song that reminds you of your time at school.
Yes. So I picked for this one Armageddon by Alkaline Trio, which is like the other half of the AFI puzzle, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, all this stuff happened at a very similar time. They were the two bands that, like, any band. Like, I met my first girlfriend going to the Joiners Arms to go to a gig. I used to sneak out my mum's house and get on the train and go into town and go to gigs at the Joiners. And I remember my first girlfriend seeing her in Subway on East Street here in Southampton. And she was, at the time, she was wearing an Alkaline Trio hoodie with the big pair of scissors at the sides, the zip-up one. And instantly I was like, oh God, she's amazing. Who's that girl? And then we ended up being together for like almost a decade, that me and that girl. And we're still like best mates now. Like, it's funny. I made all my friends around this time going out, getting drunk. You know, like the shit you do when you're a kid, like kind of sat in a park, drinking vodka straight. Like, I'd never do that now, you know? Like, yeah, why wouldn't you do that? Drinking Frosty Jacks out the bottle down by the park, you know? Getting in a fight with some kids from down the road, like that sort of thing. But this band was my whole soundtrack to that part of my life. And like every teen romance, every like late night out, every car trip to see bands, this is one of those records. Good Morning, the Alkaline Trio album, is I just hear my youth in that record. It's so funny. Because you had AFI, that were like this goth punk band. You had Alkaline Trio, this goth punk band. But the two didn't really mix much more than the fact that you'd call them a goth punk band. They were makeup. Like, they're from two different different spectrums of punk. So Alkaline Trio come from the hot water music, kind of the Lawrence Arms, the kind of more kind of get drunk and do drugs, that sort of culture. Meanwhile, you've got Davey Havoc and AFI from the hardcore scene, straight edge people, who don't do any of that stuff. And they're very different types of music, different paces. But this one, I picked this one in particular because it's the only song. This song is from from Here to Infirmary, and it's the only song on the record with a double time beat at the end. And so we loved it. We were waiting for this song. And Derek, the drummer from Alkaline Trio, is one of the best drummers you'll ever see. He's absolutely outrageous. I remember going to see Alkaline Trio in Exeter once, and I got to work the show, my friend was like, oh, we're putting it on Alkaline Tree. Do you want to come load some gear? I was like, yes, I do. And I watched them on the side of the stage, and I watched them Skiba turn around, and he had a roadie just filling up little glasses of little shots of whiskey for him. And he go over to him. I was standing next to him, and he go over to him and lick his lips, going like that. So the guy needed to fill it up again. And what that meant was every time he was doing that, the band had to be carried, and the drummer just carried them through this like it was nothing. So he stopped playing guitar, did a shot of whiskey, and I was just like, wow, like no matter what happens up front with the two amazing frontmen, these amazing musicians, like Matt's obviously having one of the nights, the drummer's keeping this all together, and you kind of realize the value in the rhythm section and how like how important and prominent that a good bass player and a good drummer are. Yeah. That's the foundation of the entire band. A bit amazing, yeah. Late nights, driving around, hanging out, going to Auckland Tree, bunking off college to go and watch them at the Guildhall. Just amazing. I it's funny, actually. I met Skiba like years later, and he was really nice to me. I met him when I was a kid, you know, getting your autograph and all that. And I met him like at the Kerrang Awards, and I came up to him and I introduced myself and everything. And he said, oh yeah, like I've heard about you guys. Doesn't your band sound a bit like Alkaline Trio and Meatloaf? I was like, yeah, that's kind of, you got it in a nutshell there, mate. That's kind of what we sound like.
How was school? Did you enjoy it?
No, I hated school. Everyone says it's the best years of your life, and it's just rubbish nonsense. I realized that I'm not very good at being taught things. And I know that sounds like a horribly, horrible thing. I'm the eldest child, so of course, you know, you can't tell me anything. And that's my own problem. But I didn't learn very well that way. I'm not very good at being like taught things. When I'm interested in something, I can zero in on it and extract so much information and concentrate so firmly.
Will,
when
resonates so much.
Oh, really?
I've interviewed about 150 people on this podcast, and they're all creatives, and so many of them have echoed exactly what
you're
saying.
Oh, that makes me feel a lot better.
You're not alone. You're not alone, mate.
It's a funny thing. I'm really glad you said that. Like, sometimes I worry about it. I'm like, you know, it's just, like my girlfriend says to me all the time, you go through these phases, Will. You get into something for like intensely for a month, and you want to talk about that to me every single day, and then the next month you're never going to speak about that ever again. You're going to move on to one other thing, and that's going to be your thing for the entire. And that's kind of how things go, like with me. But I struggle. I've always struggled with learning like that. I often wonder if we're at the right age to be learning and getting up early and at that point in time. Like, I think like my brain's, I know it shouldn't be that way, but I think I'm more susceptible to and want to learn about science and things now than I did in school. I just wanted to play with wrestling toys, you know, like yeah. That's like, you know, I wanted to make up storylines for my wrestlers, and I wanted to watch movies. I didn't want to be there, like, you know, learning what the mean, median, and mode is, you know, like what? Yeah. That's never helped me. Like, so yeah, I didn't like it. I didn't have many friends. I spent a lot of time listening to music and making art, little arty films. And I was like, I was just sure I was going to go into film. That's where I really saw myself.
You wanted to be a filmmaker?
Yeah, yeah. I didn't want to be a singer. Like, I love watching bands, but I was never. I got beaten up really bad one time in Emsworth, in Portsmouth, and I developed like a real stutter. And I still speak really fast now, but it's taken years to get rid of it. So like the idea of getting on stage and speaking to a crowd of people would just seem impossible to me. I was much more comfortable being behind the scenes and being a creative working on something than being at the front of something, which is so weird to say. But
did you not like attention then as a young man?
Oh yeah, I loved attention, but like, and I acted out and I was a nightmare, but like, not like not to perform, you know, like that wasn't really, I was like somebody made things a lot. And I just didn't see myself doing that. I loved it. Like, and I idolized singers. I loved the idea of the front man, but I never had singing lessons. You know, I didn't learn music. I didn't go to music school. I just literally fell into doing this because I love punk so much. And, it's a really weird story about how I ended up doing this. I was a promoter, and I was basically putting little DIY gigs when I was in the punk scene in Southampton. And one of the bands called up one day and said, like, to my mum's house, back when landlines were a thing. And I picked up the phone and they were like, oh, it was Chris from a band called Our Time Down Here. And he said, Will, our singers, we've kicked our singer out. I said, oh, shit, you're not going to be able to play the gig then. And he goes, oh, no, I know that you've played in some things over the years with school bits. Would you do it? And I was like, oh, God, it seems quite narcissistic to put on a gig and then play the gig, you know. But I ended up doing it. And I was just, because all my mates, anyway, we always swapped members from different bands over the years, did it at the Firehouse in Southampton here, a metal pub down here. And they were like, oh, that was all right, wasn't it? Just do it some more. And so it did. And that was 7 years gone. 7 years of working at One Stop and Domino's Pizza and selling love film in the street to support this weird little band we did that had no direction. It wasn't. We were never trying to get signed. It was never anything like that. We just made things. And then I ended up just being the singer from this band. And then like we stopped doing it because I was still living at my dad's house and it was kind of a bit unfair on everybody. Tried to have a real job for a bit. Hated that. You know, real jobs are rubbish.
They're well overrated, mate.
They really are. Like, and you know, I preferred. Like, I tried to get like a call center job. You know, like business professional, and not work hustling things on the street. That paintball trials and things that I used to be doing, charity stuff and all that. This nonsense I did for years and years. Anyway, hated that. Called up Ian and said, I don't want to tour ever again. We were about 24 at the time. And I said, but I don't want to do this. I don't want to tour ever again because it financially destroyed us and it was a nightmare and everyone involved. but like, can we do a band for the weekends? Ricky's going to put an American band will come through. It'll let us open up for one of those bands. And then we did it. And that was the band that got signed. And then I was forced back into it again. It's pulled me back in. So
you only play weekends though, right?
Oh yeah, exactly. You can only book me at the weekends. In fact, you can book me any time at the moment. I'm doing nothing at all.
Hello, I've interrupted the podcast again, haven't I? Sorry, it won't take a sec. All I want to say is, the songs that we're talking about in this podcast, if we can't play them, it's just because of the regulations regarding playing licensed music and such. So, if you want to hear the songs, just go over to Spotify and search Off the Beat and Track podcast and you can listen to all the songs because I've put playlists up for each of these. If you can't find it on there, I'll send links on all the social media accompanying each episode, so you've just got to press that one.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
...button and you can go through and you can enjoy all the songs that our guest picks. Anyway, I'll shut up, get back to the podcast. See you on the other side. Track 4, what was the first record you remember buying? Well, it weren't a record, was it? It would have been a CD.
It was a CD and I know exactly what it was. It was Mechanical Animals, Marilyn Manson. It was my cousin had got me into Marilyn Manson. He was like well into nu metal. We went to a Catholic school, and he schooled "I'm Not a Slave to a God That Doesn't Exist" on his backpack in Tippex, and wore it to school. I remember it being like an uproar. at the Marilyn Manson lyrics.
Marilyn Manson's pretty fucking punk at a Catholic school.
Yeah, sick, isn't it? I remember thinking he was a badass. I was never that daring. I could never have done that. He was really cool. I looked up to him a lot. He got me into a lot of music. He was really, really arty, very quiet, a lot quieter than me. As you can tell, I talk a lot, and it's a nightmare. Everyone wants me to shut up all the time. But yeah, he was a lovely bloke, Adam, my older cousin. And I saw Marilyn Manson and I saw David Bowie. That's what I saw. And I saw that album cover. I was like, oh, this is something I absolutely understand. I know this music because I spent 10,000 hours listening to these records on my own in my mum's house, putting on my mum's makeup in the mirror to try and look like David Bowie. You know, like I used to do that all the time. Weird, all that stuff you do when you're a kid. And now I do literally do that for a living. And my mum was sure I was gay, and she was only half right there. It's funny, all that stuff. So the makeup and all the drama and the playing with gender and all of that stuff was stuff that was right up the front of my mind. I knew it so well, and I bought it. And I loved it. I thought it was absolutely amazing. What an incredible album! I had the version with the blue cover, the jewel case, the blue cover, yeah. And you could run the album art underneath, and secret messages would come up because it was blue and it would pop out. And it was just the attention to detail to what he did and how manicured the whole thing was, and his evolution. He was doing a Bowie again. He was doing Madonna. One of those shapeshifters. And what I always thought was really interesting about Marilyn Manson was that he wasn't a very good singer. He was always been an awful singer, but he's an incredible creative. So I saw a lot of myself in him as well. I was like, oh, wow, this guy's just got loads of ideas. Like, he's head and shoulders above and so far beyond everybody else. He's, everyone's saying he's Alice Cooper, and he is that to a degree. But it's also incredibly, there's a lot more nuance than Alice Cooper. There's a lot more going on here than just great songs and cutting someone's head off on stage. There was a lot of political statements he was making of his music. And I really responded to that. That was something that really, really spoke to me. And I remember how much Coma White reminds you of a David Bowie song and Speed of Pain or that song. It was so varied and so different. And still a metal record. Your metal mates that fucking Judas Priest and stuff still kind of got on with Marilyn Manson. He was all right, you know. And
But the indie cool. kids, you know, the indie kids were like, could see the Bowie, could see the, you know, could see the artistry that transcended beyond just the, you know, just beyond, you know, the genre of metal as well. I think it, like Marilyn Manson, for me, you know, I guess he come through maybe just around the, oh, I suppose he came around in the time of new metal, wasn't it? That he came to the sort of forefront, really, with what was Sweet Dreams first, and then
Smells Like Children. Portrait of an American Family. Which I can't really recall.
And I remember, I DJ and have always DJed in alternative venues, and the impact that had. And I remember sort of, you know, you can fast track it when it's a cover, so instantly people know Sweet Dreams anyway. But then when he dropped Beautiful People, it was like, fuck me.
Outrageous. Outrageous song.
And just the, you know, I can hear Nine Inch Nails in that. I can hear so much stuff that, you know, as a 47-year-old man, so many different bands that I'd grown up listening to, I just thought, Marilyn Manson's a fucking clever geezer. He's literally just harnessed so much cool stuff and then packaged it with the most exciting looking persona that with every album just evolved and like shapeshifted. And I'll tell you a little story that at the time, it was just before my band got signed and we went to see a major label and we was doing quite kind of, I guess, post-grunge kind of anthemic kind of alternative rock, I guess, whatever you'd call it, but quite grown up sounding. This is the era of like Radiohead and things like that. And I remember sitting in the label, the label office. I won't say what label it was, but it was one of the big majors. And I went, you know, what do you think? He went, well, yeah, we like the songs, but to be honest, do you think? And he held up a picture of my band, and he went, do you think people want like rock music with guys that just kind of look like this, which was us just dressed in jeans and tees, or do you think they're going to be interested in this? And held up Kerrang with Marilyn Manson on the cover, who was the next big thing. And I was like, yeah, I get that.
Like, wow.
Like, man, I mean, it was a kick in the dick, but like...
All that ever, I'd love to hear some more stories from but like, I bet you got some amazing ones from that time. Like, because that era of the music industry, especially the alternative music industry, this fascinates me, because I was a kid when that was going on. And that was all the stuff I read and all the stuff I ingested. And now seeing it from this side of the fence, years later, it's a different world now to how it was back then.
And it was,
but like, every now and again, someone from a Kerrang will tell me something, and I'll be like, wow, like, so cool.
And it was so weird that when you look at the track, you know, how that alternative music scene evolved from, you know, Kurt basically and Nirvana just going, right, this cock rock thing, that's got to go. And, you know, and then, you know, when Nirvana come along dressed in ripped jeans, you know, lumberjack shirts, no one cared for Guns N' Roses, Skid Row, Motley Crue at that point. No one cared. It was like, it weren't about image. It was about Kurt and Nirvana and Pearl Jam and these bands that just, it was about the music. And then it's weird how that then started to kind of, when that finished, it went back to people wanting glamour, wanting something really iconic to look at. And when you look at Marilyn Manson, he delivered that. You know, he's got every bit of angst and anger that Kurt had, that Axl had, and like, but he then just threw in Bowie and Mark Bolan and Nine Inch Nails, and then you just got this. I'm wittering on now. I'm sorry, Will. I know this is your
minute guest in it. No, I literally love hearing it. Like this is the stuff
that I
care about.
How it evolved into that.
I always think that. I literally was just saying the other day, like in some interview, I was saying how I feel like a lot of the time with my band on a much smaller scale, the reason that like I think we got a chance and got given a shot was because at the time, like my cam had broken up. That happened quite a while ago. And everyone had gone to be in kind of quite straight up hardcore bands in our scene. It was a little bit more straight up again. I think that the pendulum just sways constantly back and forth. You know, think about when the glamrock stuff was killed off, then the LA kind of hair metal scene getting killed off. It kind of ebbs and flows. It flip flops back and forth. This theatricality in this music. But certainly Manson, my God, because he had the perfect face for it as well. Do you know what I mean? Like his actual face. You know, those big lips, and he was like, he always just looked like he was from another world anyway. And the transition, I bet you remember it really well, from Antichrist Superstar to Mechanical Animals, where he went from this being like this, literally looking like the devil. And that's how he was perceived in middle America at the time, you know? He was public enemy number one he transformed himself into an alien.
And what was brilliant was... You know, he was the Antichrist. And I don't know if you've seen the film Bowling for Columbine.
Oh, of course, yeah.
And the line he says in that, because everybody was blaming shock rocker Marilyn Manson.
For
these lads just, who obviously were quite unwell, done these horrendous things. And just when that news reporter says to Manson, like, what would you have done if you could have spoke to him? And he said, nothing, I would have listened to him. And now you just think, fuck, man, that's a great answer, man.
I think that's like one of my favourite things. Like, especially this is the problem. Like, so I'm such a big fan of Manson, especially around those three records, Going to Hollywood. And there's a handful of amazing news footage from that time. When he was also when he appeared on Jerry Springer. And was it Jerry Springer? One of those American talk shows. And he just outwits everybody. He was so much more intelligent than everyone who was trying to critique him. And he, again, always two steps ahead of everybody. Like to be able to, like that one line in that film, like for me, that's one of my favorite parts of that whole film. I think it's such an important thing. He was so much more in tune with the youth than the people who were trying to tear him down for the older generation.
Yeah.
But now, I don't know whether he's kind of, he's entered that older generation now. And there's a new... it's a different that's kind of happens, isn't it? So what records do you make when you're no longer part of youth culture anymore, you know?
But you become Bowie and you just constantly evolve. You constantly evolve, and
I think so, that's what you should do too. But maybe he's like I don't know, what do you feel of his recent efforts?
It's not really something I get overly excited about, I'm not going to lie. I'm more interested in him as a person than his music nowadays. You know, if there's ever an interview with him, I'm on board. I'm interested. But musically, it doesn't scream at me anymore.
I speak to Dan Carter quite a lot about, you know,
he's a very good friend of mine.
Yeah. Oh, I love him. We call each other and talk about chaos magic all the time recently. I'm trying to do a Radio 1 thing the other day. I ended up talking about magic on air.
He lives about 10 minutes down the road.
I know. And I try to stop myself. But he's brilliant, Dan. And he knows Manson really well. They text each other. And I keep thinking to myself, every time he says that to me, imagine getting a text from Marilyn Manson. how insane is that? You know, it's like when Ricky Gervais made friends with David Bowie, and they would just hang out after he'd done a David Bowie pastiche in another life. You know,
yeah.
And now they were just friends. Love it. It's so, that's absolutely bizarre, isn't it?
Track 5, Will, the song that soundtracked your year's clubbing.
Oh, this one is Against Me. Pints of Guinness Make You Strong. So this is another side. I don't speak about how important Against Me were half as much as I should do. Against Me, I was like a militant DIY punk kid when I was younger. I was like, you know, it's so funny. I've ended up on a major label. I've really sold out. But when I was a kid, I was like really, really, really into kind of anarcho-punk and those scenes. Southampton was like an amazing place for that. There was so many cool bands, so many house shows going on all the time. I was a big part of that scene. And the way I found myself there was through Against Me. I can't remember exactly how I found them. I think I may have seen like an older band. There's always like this kind of, when you get into music, there's always the older kids playing in local bands. You look up to them, you know. I had loads of them from down here. Jets vs. Sharks were mine. They were this amazing band from Portsmouth. Sounded like Grade, you know, like that sort of era of music. Really cool, like a hardcore band, but with that kind of, I don't know, like kind of like some of that Jade Tree stuff in there. It was really, really cool. And I think I saw the drummer wearing an Against Me shirt, and I was like, I need to check this band out. And we said, that's how we used to find bands, on T-shirts, on the back of totally. CDs. Who are they thanking in their album, you know, like, and yep. going by the records like that. And I remember me and my girlfriend at the time, Kay, went to FM Music in the Bargate Centre here. That's none of this is here anymore. They've actually bulldozed that to the ground. We went in there, Independent Records, and we bought one album each, and she got As the Eternal Cowboy, and I got Reinventing Axl Rose. And it just changed everything. It changed like, the politics on it, the way they spoke about Reinventing Axl Rose as an album is about reinventing the conventional rock star. And a lot of that, the ethics talking about touring in a DIY scene just made you want to be in a DIY punk band. And Pints of Guinness starts with this amazing kind of snare roll going into it. And it's got this chorus, the gang vocals on that. Gang vocals have always been like, such a part of some of my favorite punk records ever. This like a choir, because that's what a show is, you know, it's just people jumping on each other and singing. And the chorus for that, you know, just like James, I'll be drinking Irish tonight. Like that, when that first comes in, it's just so anthemic. I was obsessed, and I still am. Like Laura Jane Grace is such an inspiration to me, and has been for years and years and years. She actually shouted my band out last year when we were in a social media blackout for one of these stunts we were doing. And so I couldn't respond to it, but I was freaked out. Absolutely. Such a massive fan. And it reminds me, there used to be a nightclub down here. I don't know if you ever came to Unit, but it was before, it was just after Nexus closed down here. I don't know if you ever DJed there. But it was a free floor club for alternative music, which obviously would never work now. But like it did at the time, I don't know why.
Yeah.
And Ricky used to, he does the Joiners now, one of my best friends, used to run the middle bar. And I used to go there and get absolutely out of my mind. And it was so much fun because he was in control of the music on that floor as well.
Yeah.
And we would put on that, and all of me and my friends would just sing along to that. I would reach over his bar and pour myself a glass of wine. He'd go, stop doing that. Stop doing that. And there was just all of those nights out where you're just getting really crazy. And, you know, the Joiners owned this nightclub, and the Joiners Arms down here is our grassroots music venue. Something I'm incredibly proud of and played a really prominent part of my life. They're my family, you know, all the people who own it and love them. I have so many amazing memories of being in their establishments, dancing to Against Me, singing along. And just getting really, really drunk. It's drinking music, and that's what that this is. And it's kind of fuck the system, proper punk rock. It's recorded the way it sounds. It couldn't be produced better. Even though it's not got that major label sheen that they would go on with when they signed Desire. It's just amazing. It's just is what it is. It sounds like what you're at when you're at one of those shows. I remember going to I think it's in the Mean Fiddler they shot it. It was the Mean Fiddler. He's not there anymore either. Rest in peace, the Mean Fiddler in Astoria. To see Against Me record their a live album. It was one of the first times I saw them. I've seen them so many times over the years, but they were absolutely magic. It was just crazy. The whole room felt like it was unified, you know? You know when you can hear everyone around you singing? And it's like, oh my God, this is what punk rock is to me. It's all these people with the same values and ideas and ethics. I mean, music about questioning the world around you, about, animal liberation, talking about... It taught me so much, like being kind of just a guy from an all white school, like just challenging you as well. Like that's what punk rock always was to me. It was about questioning the way I was and the way I looked at the world and like racism. And we're talking loads about that at the moment, obviously, with everything that's going on. But, you know, the punk scene was discussing these things and making people challenge themselves and challenge everything around them in my life for years and years and years. And it's, I think Against Me, a band that for getting me into that scene in the first place, that scene would change my whole life, my whole outlook and everything. And a lot of that was also in evenings, just a drunken mess singing along to these songs.
All right, well, let's stay in the home county, because that's track 6, a favourite song from an artist from your home county.
So I've chosen a weird one for this one. So me and Ian...
This is the one I didn't know.
Yeah, you won't know this one because it's from a local band down here. So me and Ian used to play in two separate bands. Our first tour, Ian plays in Creeper, obviously, like he's the guitar player in my band. But we toured together our entire lives. We built our entire life together. Our careers all built together. But it was never always like this. He used to play in a band called Take 'Em Out, which is the funniest name in the world. It's a terrible, terrible name. Take 'Em Out. It's back at the time that everyone was really into Youth Crew hardcore. And they sounded like Champion and a lot of those kind of Bridge Nine bands. But our first tour together we weren't playing in the same band. Take 'Em Out toured, and so did my band, Art I'm Down Here. This is back in 2009, I want to say, a long time ago. And we didn't know anything about tour. We just put loads of gigs and went out and did them. But like, there was 9 of us, and we had 2 6-seater vans because that's what we could get. So we put all the gear in the back of one of them, and the rest of us just laid down in the back of the other van. Just drove around the country playing all these gigs. And they had this song called We'll See It Through. Oh, have I lost you? There we're back.
No.
We'll See It Through. And it was this ridiculous, kind of like it was just like an Americana-style hardcore song. But everyone in our city knew that song. So when they play, everyone would dance, everyone would kind of pile on and get the mic, and it was like, this song every single time they play, and we're waiting for We'll See It Through. And it had this kind of gang shout at the end, We'll See It Through till the end. It was like really shouty and really aggressive and really, really fun. Everyone would jump and pile on at their last show, which I put on at the King Alf, a football pub by St Mary's down here. Ian broke the headstock of his guitar because everyone jumped on him and it fell down. He broke the entire headstock off. So they couldn't even play the end of the song, which is like the whole reason they were known. But I have such fond memories of that song and growing up playing with Ian. It's kind of how we met. It's how our whole scene kind of came together down here for our little generation of hardcore and punk. And it was just amazing. It's like a really silly song. It's really, really fast. It's very, very much of that time period. It's very much of American hardcore rather than anything British. But like personally, like on a personal level, it holds a lot of weight with me. And it's just a really, really fun thing to remember. All those nights going to gigs. I used to put on like hardcore bands from all around the world. So I used to put on like bands from Europe, and I put on like a Malaysian hardcore straight edge band called Second Combat. And Take 'Em Out would always be the support band. And they would always play the song. And the whole room would just go crazy for this one song every single time. So I've chosen that one because I felt like that was a really apt one. Also, I'm going to score points with Ian for mentioning his old band. So
wonderful. That's great. All right, well, for the last track, well, you get to play DJ and recommend a song that many may not know that you would like them to hear.
I chose a few here, but in my notes, I'm just going to read the ones that I chose. Can I choose a few? Oh, no, I'm actually happy with my choice for this one. I chose a song by a band that's actually got quite a lot more recognition now in like over the recent years. But by a band called Cold Cave. The song's called Glory. And so Cold Cave is the side project of Wes Isold, who is the singer in American Nightmare and Give Up the Ghost later on. He's just one of my favorite lyricists. I just think he's an incredibly creative guy. He inspires me an awful amount. And he went on to do this kind of, he was really into Sisters of Mercy and a lot of that, a lot of kind of electronic music. And he was born with one hand. And so he couldn't play guitar. So he learned to play keyboards. He's just the king. Like, he's just the king of this stuff. He's nailed the aesthetic down, and the branding of what he does is next level. He's very well read. He owns the Heartworm Press, where he presses poetry books. And so he's just a really, really wonderful writer, which I think he always was in American Nightmare too. But especially on this song, it's just a beautiful song. Some of it reminds me of like a Heroes David Bowie vibe. There's the lyric, I can be you and you can be me too. Or whatever, you know, I could be you and you could be me too. I just love it. It makes me think of my girlfriend, and it makes me really, it's a love song. And every time I hear that first beat come in, I just want to dance. And I love this sort of music. I got really into like kind of dark wave and a lot of that sort of stuff. Comes along with when you grow up listening to Marilyn Manson and AFI, you know, this is where we all wash up. And in the dark wave world when you get older. Wes is like the undoubtedly the king of that, you know. He's a guy that kind of, Cold Cave to me is so prolific that it almost overshadows the other stuff he's done, which is already amazing. I love American Nightmare is my favorite hardcore band. It's just a beautiful song. He sings in that lovely baritone. There's some records, that record Cherish the Light Years, which is like a full length of this stuff. And it's a lot more kind of poppy than some of his other stuff. But I love that too. It's just amazing. The lyric, there's a really great lyric. It's important. It's important evil people look so good on the outside. And there's like this really clever wordplay. I've always wanted to write like that. And it's actually, I have to be careful I don't too much, because he sued Fall Out Boy for stealing his lyrics, did you remember?
Oh, really?
Yeah, so under the cork tree. So Wes is just this amazing lyricist. Like, it is amazing. When you read it, like, I got a load of his poetry books. They're like some of my favorite things that I have. And Deathbeds is the main ones, like kind of the anthology of a lot of his work from when he was in Some Girls and a lot of his writings. And Under the Cork Tree, Fall Out Boy. Fall Out Boy have got some cool lyrics, but I think they owe a lot of their writing style to Wes Isold. So much so that he got a load of money because they literally lifted verses from his songs. But they're all friends. They all grew up in the same scenes and things as well. But I think it got to a point where like he had to be made a co-writer on the songs. And I think he's made some good money off of that, which I'm really, really pleased that he's managed to do, because I'm hoping that it assists with his more creation from him. And I'll just digest and buy anything he makes, really, because it's funny. You get to a certain point in your life, don't you, where certain people, they have such a high quality of what they do that like, you know, it's going to be good, even if it's not like your favorite thing they've done. It's going to be better than what other people are doing, and so you just buy it anyway. You know, like that's just kind of the way I am with it. He's just an amazing, amazing lyricist, an amazing songwriter, and I love this particular song. It's a single, and I just really, really rate it. Like, I grew up with the Sisters of Mercy stuff as well. I grew up with a lot of like New Order and stuff like that, and a lot of the reference points he has really speak to me. From, as I said earlier on, like going to records at my mum's house and finding all this music, all this amazing stuff, and this is like, again, it's like, it's something happening now that I can go and watch. Like, you know, it's not a prestige or like a kind of, it's not like a homage that's taken too far. He's done his own thing with it. And I don't know how he's managed to, because it's hard to these days. But yeah, just brilliant. I can't talk him up enough. I think he's a little genius, and I just really rate him.
Well, we put a Spotify playlist together to accompany this podcast, so people will be able to go and listen to it
great.
As well, alongside all the other tracks that we've spoke about on this podcast. So as we start to sort of find ourselves easing our way out of lockdown and hopefully to a safe and brighter future, what's coming up?
Well, we're about to release our record, like our second record, and it's it's the first release we've had since 2017. So it's quite a while ago we released anything. So I'm very excited about it. I feel like this record's been cursed. I've been saying this a lot recently. There's like, you know, The Exorcist was a cursed film.
Yeah.
And I feel like this album's like, oh my God, I'm worried about people owning it. I'm hoping the curse is lifted when we get to the when it gets the release date. That's what I've been saying in my head. Like, it's either that or, like, you know, it's like a Ghostbusters scenario and it all goes wrong and it all goes everywhere. You know, we're all infected, you know. We've been through the ringer with this one. You know, like, we really have. It's been so many panic attacks and late nights and kind of fights and my mum's partner passed away. It's been a lot of death and tragedy in this. And Ian got very, very unwell while we were making it. So he was sectioned in the priory down here, and so there's been a lot of very real world trauma. But even like in a more like ridiculous sense, the cello player that came and did his strings broke his leg on the way into the studio one day. The Graham Humphreys, the man who does all of our amazing poster art, if you've ever seen our tour posters, he did all the Nightmare on Elm Street stuff. He fell down an escalator and broke his leg. The plant that pressed the records in California. Our record went through, and there was a fire, and it burnt down. Like, honestly, I know.
We'll wrap this podcast up right now because.
Yeah, I can't stress to you. Like, we talk about the creeper curse in this one. It's really been a journey, and since when we put out our last one to this place, I know. We actually spoke about earlier on. Bands are throwing out material now, left, right, and center, and this is an unusually long gap for a band's follow up. In this climate, anyway. But it's an unusual record. It's weird. It's weird as shit. It's a weird record. And I love it. I'm really, really proud of it. It's Patricia from Sisters of Mercy does spoken word on it. We managed to get like friends of ours involved and to do things. And
wow.
I know, man. It's so cool. I met Patricia. She's obviously Dave Vanian's partner. And I love The Damned. One of my favorite bands of all time. Went to see The Damned so many times. I met them both at the Kerrang Awards again. Like the year after my ridiculous Skiba story. I met them both there. And turns out they've been taking their daughter Emily to see Creeper because she's a Creeper fan. And so I was like, oh no way! I literally love like Fuddland is one of my favorite records, you know. And like Machine Gun Etiquette, that was like the soundtrack to was when I was younger too, you know. Like I was like, God, this is amazing. So we became friends, and they would come to. So Creeper things, and we you know, obviously, like, we would never make them pay to see us ever. They're like royalty to me, and goth royalty. And so yeah, really, really cool. They invited me and my girlfriend to the Damned show with the Circus of Horrors at the Palladium. And they, like, we had like first
he
in the
looks
front.
So good, Dave Vanian.
Oh God, it was so sick. It was so cool. And then we went to the after show. Imagine this, okay? Like, me and my girlfriend are both really bad goths. You know, we're so into that scene. So, like, this is like a dream come true for us. We had the Circus of Horrors, and then it was The Damned, where he shaved his hair off at the intermission and became Nosferatu, came back out dressed up as Nosferatu midway through the performance. I was, like, amazing. And my girlfriend loves him as well. And so they invited us to the after show. We entered this after party down in I think it was in Soho somewhere. And I was like, well, you have to go. You know, we have to go. And we went in. They gave us a glass of wine, and we went and found a table while a man played Aladdin Sane on the piano. A pianist just sat there and played the entirety of Aladdin Sane. And then Dave Vanian came over, and we hung out with Emily. And I was like, this is the coolest thing in the world. You guys are so – why are you being so nice to us? We're just like these little weird punk kids, you know. Like, so they're lovely, lovely, lovely people. And I wanted an American voice to play the character in my American record. So I asked Patricia if she would do it, and she was so lovely and said, oh, yeah, of course, I'll come by. Came by the studio in London. We were doing some bits and just was amazing, just amazing. It was like a dream come true. So, yeah, it's a spectacularly weird record we've made. It's very varied, very odd. The middle section is a country song. There's a doo-wop number. It ends with a piano ballad, and there's a song that sounds like Suede in the middle of all that nonsense. It's just going on and on and on. I'm very proud of it. It's a very odd record, and we've really tried to go all in on it. And it's finally coming out on July 31st.
Wonderful. Well, I'll
the curse will be lifted.
Well, this podcast, when it comes out, the album will be out, so we'll add some tracks onto the playlist as well, so people can get a real flavour that may not have heard Creeping Music before. And where's a good place for people to find out about what Creeper are up to?
So you can find out all the usual places. You can find us on Twitter, Creeper Cult UK, on Instagram, it's all the same tag, on Facebook. We have a website as well, which has recently been kind of redone, which is a lot better than when we made it originally. It is creepercult.com. Oh my God, not creepercult.com.
Oh, mate, that's what you so should have called it that.
We're a completely different type of creeper there. You know how many times we get tagged in weird things in the course of this band on the internet? Pervy dudes looking up a woman's skirt, tagging Creeper Cult on Twitter, or just on Facebook, getting tagged in loads of photos where like someone's taking a family photo and someone's photobombed it at the back, and they've tagged him, that guy as a creeper, but they've tagged the band Creeper as well. So we get tagged in all these really funny pictures all the time, or really horrendous kind of like gross things.
I don't know if that's really like bad or incredibly brilliant marketing.
I mean, I don't really want to be known as the band that's associated with these things, to be honest with you. But that is the risk we ran when we named the band Creeper. You know, a word that with my lisp, I constantly call Creeper. So, you know, it's...
There's nothing wrong with having a lisp, mate. I've been podcasting for a few years with one. It's fine. Will, thank you so much for your time today, mate. It's been a real pleasure.
Oh, no, I've really enjoyed it. Thank you so much. I really, really enjoyed chatting to you about all of this nonsense, you know. It's been good hearing your side of the Marilyn Manson stuff as well. What a cool story. That's mad.
And best of luck with the album, buddy.
Thank you so much. Are we going for real now on the chat as well?
No, I'm going to press stop on here and then I'll say thank you to you afterwards. It's always weird. No one ever knows what to do here, because I've done a few where I've gone, oh, thank you very much for being on, and then I've pressed stop, and then they've gone, okay, thanks, and then they just hung up the Zoom recording. I was like, oh, I was actually going to say thank you separately from that. So we'll do that. So I'm going to press stop on here. There you go. Oh, that was a wonderful chat. And as we finished that podcast with that awkward moment that we discussed, we carried on chatting afterwards. And yeah, what a top lad. Go and check out the album. Obviously, go and check out the playlist on Spotify as well. Huge thanks to Tom Dark as well for facilitating this podcast. And thanks once again to Will for giving up his time. And most of all, thank you to you, lovely lot, for listening. As mentioned at the beginning, why not go and have a look in the archives and see if there's another episode that tickles your fancy? Best still, just subscribe. That's what we want. Subscribe to the podcast. Leave a little review. You know, let us know what you thought. All these things really help to support this podcast. So, yeah, if you can, that'd be lovely. I'm back next week. I'll see you soon. Bye-bye. Oh, yeah. Sorry. I've butted in yet again. I just want to quickly tell you about this magazine. It's called Pod Bible. Now, Pod Bible is the new essential guide to podcasts. It's put together alongside Spotify and Acast. And it's a one-stop shop to tell you all about the podcasts you maybe know about, but definitely about a load of the podcasts that you probably don't know about that we think you should know about. I mean, in the first edition, there's interviews with Adam Buxton, interviews with Craig Parkinson, there's features on Jade Adams, and there's just an abundance of information about so many exciting podcasts that are out there. Also, Spotify have given us these amazing little codes. So if you do get a print copy, you can just turn on your Spotify on your phone, scan the little code, and it just automatically opens up the podcast on your listening device. How good's that? If you haven't managed to get a print copy, then just go over to www.podbiblemag.com and read it online, because the digital version is all over there and it's all free. So every other month there'll be a new edition out. So go and have a look and support us on the social medias as well. PodBibleMag.com.
It's Off the Beat and Track podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network. With me, Stu Whiffin.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.